murder, then you should criminalize it. In a free society, are you willing to do that? And if not, to the woman, then why are you willing to do it to the doctor she finds? Because you can't face the criminalization question.
That's Chris Matthews. He's host of Hardball on NBC, but he was appearing there making some comments and asking a difficult question about Roe v. Wade of pro-lifers on a recent edition of the Laura Ingraham radio program. That's a good question. We'll be talking about that during the course of this hour, this first hour of Issues, etc. today. But the bigger question is, after Roe, what? There's a real possibility in the next 4 years that there could be some significant changes on the U.S. Supreme Court. And that's what this really all comes down to. The whole presidential election and the aftermath. After Roe, what? If it is possible that we might see in the not-so-distant future a challenge to Roe, and if it's possible that it could at some point be overturned or reversed, what happens then? You say, well, it goes to the states. Right. We know that. What really happens then? What will the law concerning abortion have to look like post-Roe? Our guest in this hour, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. He's professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's a distinguished professor of apologetics and the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, an author and editor of more than 50 books, including Slaughter of the Innocents. Dr. Montgomery, welcome back to Issues, Etc.
Thanks so much.
Dr. Montgomery, let's just deal with Roe as law. Is it good law or bad law, just in terms of what makes for a good, decent lawmaking?
It's very, very bad law, and most of the commentators who have analyzed it have seen it as such. The problem with Roe versus Wade is that the reasoning of the court is based upon an alleged doctrine of privacy in the Constitution. Now, you can read the Constitution of the United States from now until the Last Judgment, and you will find no mention of privacy at all. The privacy right allegedly within the Constitution of the United States was presented in a law review article in the Harvard Law Review at the end of the 19th century, around 1890, as I recall. And Warren and Brandeis did this article, and they argued for an implied right of privacy. Well, the Supreme Court in Roe versus Wade said the pregnant mother has this right to privacy, and unless she can abort, people will know about it. They'll know that she was pregnant, and therefore, at least during the first trimester of pregnancy, the first 3 months of pregnancy, she has the absolute right to determine whether to carry the child or not. Now, even if there is a right of privacy in the Constitution of the United States, it doesn't follow that you can kill a human being in order to protect it. As I have noted on many occasions, if an encyclopedia salesman starts throwing volumes of the encyclopedia through my bedroom window at night, and when I'm on the toilet seat, he opens the window and says, "Please buy my encyclopedia," he's certainly violating my right to privacy. Eh? But I can't take a sawed-off shotgun and kill him. If I kill him, for heaven's sake, this is an overreaction, and this turns out to be homicide. So even if there is a right to privacy in the U.S. Constitution, it would not justify killing the unborn. So Roe versus Wade is one bad piece of law.
So is that essentially how, if you had the opportunity before a more favorable Supreme Court to make the case that Roe needs to be reversed, is that how you would make the case that Roe is bad law and hasn't gotten any better?
I would make it in those terms, and I would also point out that there are only two ways that you can identify a human being. You can identify a human being in a genetic chromosomal fashion, which is thoroughly scientific, and on that basis, the unborn has got to be regarded as a person. The only other way to do this is to try to do it functionally and to say you're only a human being if you act like a human being or you perform certain functions. But the problem with that is that the functions then are defined by the state or by philosophers or by a committee or whatever, and the end result of this is that human beings can be eliminated just on the basis of sociological concerns. At the time of the Civil War in the United States, the 19th century, blacks were not given the legal protection of persons, even though they had the full genetic chromosomal characteristics of human beings, simply because states that maintained slavery claimed that they did not function as they ought to function. The analogy between slavery and abortion is a very powerful one, and I would use that before the Supreme Court of the United States. I would argue that there is an overwhelming genetic chromosomal proof that the unborn is human, and therefore the unborn deserves the full protection of the law.
So let's talk about what could happen and what would necessarily have to follow if your arguments were successful before a favorable Supreme Court and they said, you know, we're going to take this step, we're going to reverse this previous court's decision on Roe v. Wade, and we're going to overturn it. What, in terms of the legal framework of our nation, what would happen then to abortion law in the United States and the abortion question?
Well, as you already indicated, the decision on abortion would then revert to the states, which was the situation prior to Roe versus Wade. Before Roe versus Wade, each state could establish whatever abortion regulations it thought were appropriate, and that's what would happen. The unfortunate thing about that is, of course, that there are states that are very liberal, Massachusetts, where now apparently homosexuals can marry with impunity, California, etc. The Eastboard states, the Westboard states, there undoubtedly abortion would be allowed on the same basis as Roe versus Wade, or even on a more liberal basis. That would be possible. In the heartland, in the center of the United States, there would be regulations set forth that would make it very difficult for abortion to occur. Abortion would take place presumably only in the case of the danger to the life of the mother, that sort of thing. The result of this would be that the pregnant women with money would go to the states where they could get an abortion, and those without money would stay home and have the child.
Would the Supreme Court, in overturning Roe v. Wade, be basically forfeiting its agenda for the next decade, given the fact that laws both against and permitting abortion in the various states would certainly also be challenged all the way up to the Supreme Court? Would it just start the whole thing all over again?
Well, it might, although in all likelihood, if the constituency of the Supreme Court would be likely to remain the same as on the reversal of the decision, then there would not be a great point in bringing these cases again to the Supreme Court. It might well be that there would be a period in which the decision on abortion would be left to the states until a more liberal Supreme Court came on the scene. Of course, the real answer to this would be to have an amendment to the Constitution of the United States which would define the person from the moment of conception. If there were such an amendment, then the Supreme Court would be required to overturn any abortion law which made it possible to abort the unborn, except in situations of emergency. This is exactly like the problem of homosexual marriage. If there is no constitutional amendment which defines marriage as the French Constitution does, as a union between a male and a female, if there isn't anything like that in the U.S. Constitution, then you're going to have each state making a determination on its own. And this is a mess. I mean, if that's the case, if each state decides differently on this, and it goes up to the Supreme Court, and there's no constitutional principle to determine it, then clearly the state can do whatever it wants.
We're asking and answering the question here on Issues, Etc. After Roe, What? With Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. In about 40 minutes, we're going to be talking with Uwe Simonetto, our Religion Roundup. He's Religious Affairs Correspondent for United Press International and will join us from France for that roundup. We'll also be talking a little later in the program about the ad campaign that was launched and kind of bounced off the ground by the United Church of Christ. Now, we've talked about this before recently on Issues, Etc. Now, the question I have for you on that ad campaign, and we'll be hearing the ad again, the ad in question, it was rejected by both CBS and NBC for airing because they said it was too controversial. It made equivalence, race, and sexual orientation. They said that's too controversial. The question I have for you is this. Should this church body be running this ad? Should Christians be in favor of them running this ad? I'll tell you right off the bat, folks. I'm in favor of it. I think the UCC should be able to run this ad and that the networks ought to run it too, for two reasons. One, the UCC is being honest when it talks about tolerating to the point of affirming homosexuality. They're wrong, but at least they're being honest and they're laying their cards on the table. And number two, if the subject matter can be ruled unsuitable because it's controversial, what if we were to produce an ad, my church body would produce an ad with something far more controversial, the scandal of the cross at its center? We'll talk about that a little bit later. And then Suzanne Venker joins us for the last 25 minutes of the program to talk about this popular TV sitcom, Desperate Housewives. Dr. Montgomery is our guest as we ask and answer after Roe, What? Let's take up the question of criminalization then, Dr. Montgomery. We heard at the outset of the program Chris Matthews saying, look, pro-lifers refuse to deal with the issue of criminalizing abortion because it would mean that the woman would have to spend time in prison as well as the doctor. What do you make of that evaluation, first off?
Well, it's really a very superficial evaluation because the criminal law has to determine, in terms of social necessity, what is right and what is wrong. It can't take into account the possible mitigating circumstances having to do with the crime. For example, it happens to be illegal to steal bread. I mean, if you go into a pâtisserie, if you go into a boulangerie, a place where they're selling bread, whatever they're called in English, bread store, I suppose, if you go in there and you steal a loaf of bread, you are going to be prosecuted for this because it doesn't belong to you and you didn't pay for it. Now, if you are starving to death, that is certainly going to be a mitigating circumstance when it comes before the judge. But it's not going to mean that there'll no longer be any laws to prevent you from stealing bread. By the same token, if the unborn is a human, killing that human being is wrong. It is wrong, and it ought to be prosecuted. If, however, it were a situation where, let us say, this was a distraught, psychologically weak mother who already had 11 children, and the husband is an alcoholic and not bringing home enough money, and she's pregnant again, and she goes to an abortionist or something like that, and they're caught, and she is prosecuted for doing this, of course, all of those circumstances would be taken into account. She would undoubtedly receive a suspended sentence. She would not have to spend any time in jail, but the conviction would nevertheless be valid.
So, in other words, when the law is written against something, prohibiting something, the mitigating circumstances that might lead to the crime or speak against a full punishment for the crime cannot be considered when the law is being written. That is for a judge or a jury to decide when they say, okay, now what shall the sentence or what shall the actual penalty be for the crime?
Exactly, exactly. That kind of thing is taken into account in sentencing. And you know, social workers do do a write-up of the situation, and they present all of this before their pre-sentencing reports in all civilized countries that give the background of the accused, so that that can be taken into account. But you don't use that as an excuse for not having a valid law.
Now, I have heard many pro-lifers, anecdotally and others in writing, say, look, if Roe were overturned, we would have to write the law in such a way so that we could punish the doctors for performing the abortions, but no one is going to consider punishing women for having abortions because the woman is the second victim of the abortion along with the baby as well. What do you make of that kind of arguing kind of a blanket arguing on the other side of this?
Well, it's pretty convoluted reasoning. I mean, would we say, for example, in the case of illegal prostitution that we could prosecute the pimp, but we couldn't prosecute the prostitute herself, or we couldn't prosecute the John, the person who arrives and uses the prostitute or whatever, hires the prostitute? If the thing is wrong, then all the participants who voluntarily are involved in this kind of thing are going to be prosecuted. But the degree of guilt and the degree of punishment will depend upon the special circumstances in each case. I mean, if there is a law against performing abortions and a doctor does this, doesn't make any difference to me that he has an M.D., I mean, an M.D. is a much lower degree than a Ph.D. that I have anyway, so why should I take that into account? I mean, the fact of the matter is that doctors are sinners just like anybody else, and, you know, if they sell drugs, they're going to be prosecuted for that, whether they have a doctor's degree or not.
Now, what corollary would you draw between a woman who procures an abortion from an abortionist and existing laws that involve the taking of a human life? Would it be murder for hire? What would it be? How would you classify it?
No, it would probably be regarded as a voluntary homicide, all right, voluntary manslaughter, because the emotional pressure on the woman would be such that this was a killing that took place under severe emotional pressure. It would not be regarded as a premeditated killing in the sense of murder, but you know, voluntary homicide is no fun for anybody, and it would certainly involve a severe penalty unless it could be shown that she was psychologically so overwhelmed by her circumstances that she could hardly do anything else.
Or, say, in the case of, I mean, and this takes place, as you know better than I do, in China, in the case of forced or state-enforced abortion, something like those lines would be mitigated.
Sure. In instances like that, obviously, if, for example, she were, a woman in a fundamentalist Muslim family, and this was forced upon her against her will by other people, then that would certainly constitute a sufficient defense.
You mentioned before that if Roe were overturned and the question would go back to the states, some of the states would say, fine, we're just going to continue with liberalized abortion law, and now that they don't have Roe hanging around their neck, they could come up with a far more bogus reason for having abortion decriminalized. But other states would make it a criminal and a prosecutable offense, with exceptions. Isn't that the real sticky wicket of this entire scenario? And that is, how do you not only define the exceptions, but then in law enforce exceptions as exceptions and non-exceptions as not being exceptions?
Well, yes, it seems to me that it would be an excellent situation if Roe versus Wade were reversed, simply because this would open the playing field again. It would again be possible then to discuss and debate this whole thing legally throughout the United States. But that would only be an intermediate step. It couldn't remain that way without great difficulties. As I've already mentioned, this would provide an advantage for the rich. The rich pregnant person could simply travel to a state where it would be possible to get an abortion. The poor could not. But what this would do is to open the whole thing up, and maybe we could finally get clear that the unborn with the genetic chromosomal characteristics of a human being must be regarded as a person legally, just as at the time of the Civil War, it was finally determined that even though you happened to be black in color, if you had all the characteristics of a human being, you had to be regarded as such, and you couldn't be treated as a chattel. At the present time, by Roe versus Wade, the unborn is treated as an object, which can simply be thrown out at the arbitrary decision of the pregnant mother during the first trimester of pregnancy. I mean, this is a ghastly mess, and maybe as a result of that intermediate interregnum period in which the states would determine this again, the whole thing would be thrashed through, and we could reach the point of a constitutional amendment which would define the right to life from the moment of conception. The Inter-American Court of Human Rights that sustains the Inter-American Convention on Human Rights, which is the equivalent of the European Convention on Human Rights in the Americas, has in it the statement that the right to life shall be protected in general from the moment of conception. That's what's needed in the U.S. Constitution. Justice is needed in the U.S. Constitution, a statement that marriage consists of a union between a male and a female.
We're asking and answering the question, after Roe, what, with Dr. John Warwick Montgomery, professor emeritus at the University of Luton in England, a French advocate, a barrister at law in England and Wales, and a member of the bar of the Supreme Court of the United States. He's distinguished professor of apologetics in the history of Christian thought at Trinity College and Theological Seminary in Newburgh, Indiana, and he's author and editor of more than 50 books, including a book called Slaughter of the Innocents. Now, you can find out more about Dr. Montgomery's book, Slaughter of the Innocents, and other books by Dr. Montgomery on the web at this website. It's CILTPP.com. It's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, CILTPP.com, or you can call them at area code 780-461-3876. The book is titled Slaughter of the Innocents, 780, area code 461-3876. When we come back from this break, we're going to spend more time talking with Dr. Montgomery to round off this first hour of Issues, etc., about what happens after Roe. We'll find out in the course of our conversation how likely he believes it is in the near future that Roe could be overturned if possible. Or is this really just a little bit of a question that is too premature to ask? And then what about parental notification and consent laws? I'm thinking about those states, like the state wherein I reside, Illinois, where you can't even get one of those passed. Would overturning Roe v. Wade in the Supreme Court, would it mean a crack in the dike of such states where, at this point, it's impossible even to have a parent notified or give any kind of consent for a minor child to be brought across state lines or within the state have an abortion? I'm also anxious to hear what you have to say about this. What do you think? If abortion becomes illegal, what should we do? Should we penalize the doctor? The mother? If so, what should those penalties be? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc. A Christmas tree, a wooden manger, a wooden cross. It's an arboreal theme that followed Jesus throughout his time on earth. And this theme is the focus of our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December, titled A Tree for Christmas. It's written by popular Christian author Dandy Daly McCall. Just visit our website, issuesetc.org, for more information, or call Concordia Publishing House at 1-800-325-3040. A Tree for Christmas costs $12.99 plus shipping and handling. 1-800-325-3040. Gather your children and grandchildren around the Christmas tree this year and read A Tree for Christmas. 1-800-325-3040 or issuesetc.org. What's the relationship between a Christmas tree and the tree of life? Find out with A Tree for Christmas, our Issues, Etc. book of the month for December. 1-800-325-3040.
Announcing Christ's good news to Muslims in Central Asia needs the support of ongoing prayer partners. This Global Minute lets you hear that Avant Ministries, a well-respected mission agency, is using a method called short-cycle church planning. It includes praying to find influential men or women who want to learn about Christ. Their Vice President of Field Ministries, Scott Harris, says an Avant missionary couple is hopeful in Central Asia.
We've targeted several countries there, and what it appears is that God is providing opportunity through some people in the area that he's brought to himself, that we may find our next sites through.
Pray for Muslims in Central Asia to turn to Christ and realize his deep love for them. Discover short-term and career mission opportunities through Avant's website, www.avmi.org. That's www.avmi.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Ever feel you don't have what it takes? In the second century before Christ, a foreign ruler named Antiochus Epiphanes attempted to eradicate the Jewish religion. To that end, he offered pagan sacrifices on the altar of the temple in Jerusalem. A family called the Maccabees led the Jews in successful revolt. When the Syrians had been driven out, that desecrated altar was destroyed, a new one built, and 8 days of festival declared. But there was only enough pure oil to burn candles for one of the 8 days. Even so, the priests took the little oil they had and lit the first candle. From that unpromising beginning came the first miracle of Hanukkah. That little oil lasted for the full 8 days. Our Jewish friends begin their observance of Hanukkah this evening. The greater miracle, ancient commentators said, was that those ancient priests trusted God to provide, even though it appeared they didn't have enough oil for the 8 days. Sometimes God waits for all our hopes to grow dim so that we might kindle in us the one hope that will not go out, hope in Him. 2 Corinthians 12, My grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. In dire times, you don't have what it takes. The miracle is, God does.
Next time on the Bible study, Acts chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, where Ananias and Sapphira are struck dead by God for their deception. Do you fear God's retribution in your life? Might He strike you dead? We'll talk about it with Pastor John Schmidtke next time on the Bible study. It's heard weekday mornings at 10:05.
The Bible Study on AM 850 KFUO is underwritten by Concordia Christian Books and Gifts, serving God's people.
I'm just trying to get people to think. And if you really believe it's murder, and you say, but of course the woman shouldn't be put in jail for 20 or 30 years because she's not a murderer, even though she went to see the doctor to get the abortion, then you have to say, well, then stop and think right then, because that's when you got to think. Wait a minute. Maybe this isn't like killing a person. Maybe this is different. Maybe when this is your, when this is happening to your person, that maybe it should be treated differently.
Again, it's Chris Matthews of MSNBC's Hardball on Laura Ingraham's radio program, trying to argue that criminalization, that question has not been faced by the pro-life community. One has faced it, and that is our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. We're asking and answering the question, after Roe, what? Our guest, Dr. Montgomery, is director and professor in residence for the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights. Dr. Montgomery, tell us a little bit about this academy.
Well, it takes place each summer for 2 weeks in the French Rhineland, which is a wonderful location. During the 2 weeks, the most important arguments against Christian faith are analyzed and refuted, and the 20 people who take this program each summer are given an Institute of Advanced Studies in Apologetics so that they can defend the faith with the greatest effectiveness. There are four professors in residence each summer. These are the foremost defenders of the faith in the world today. The program is full for 2005. It filled up by October, even though the technical deadline date for applications is April. Therefore, if there are listeners who want to do this, the strong advice that we have is to apply for 2006 and to do this no later than September of this coming year. The program is the most attractive program in the defense of the Christian faith anywhere in the world. It's the place to go if one wants to be able to defend the faith the most effectively possible.
Folks, if you want a free information brochure on the 10th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, the 9th is this summer, but that's be it in 2005 summer, but that's full up. If you'd like an information brochure on the 10th Annual European Summer Study of the International Academy of Apologetics, Evangelism, and Human Rights, simply call our resource line, 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172, and we'll send you a free brochure, 1-800-737-0172. Now, I want to hear from you on this issue of after Roe what? I have heard pro-lifers in the media, I have read these things that say, look, after Roe, we will criminalize abortion for the doctor, but not for the woman. Dr. Montgomery says, you can't really do that. That's kind of sloppy thinking. You have to consider that the crime has been committed by everyone involved. Now, what will the penalty be? That's a different question. So what do you think about this? After Roe, what? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. The best caller or emailer in the next half hour will get a free copy of Dr. Montgomery's book, Slaughter of the Innocents. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Montgomery, before we go on, how likely do you think it is that given the possible vacancies, it's almost certain there will be one that will be Chief Justice Rehnquist in the next year or so, given the possible vacancies facing President George W. Bush, that the Supreme Court would change sufficiently in complexion to reconsider Roe?
Very difficult to say. I am not a prophet nor the son of a prophet. The replacement of Rehnquist would not solve the problem because Rehnquist is conservative, and if he were replaced with a conservative, that would not alter the balance on the court. What's necessary is to have either one of the liberal justices replaced or one of the swing vote justices replaced by someone who's as strong as Scalia, for example. And it's awfully hard to know what's going to happen. The justices who favor the liberal position on abortion are probably going to try to hang on through the next 4 years, simply to, on the hope that after that time there may be a president who would not take the same approach that that Bush does. But if, let us say, two swing vote justices or two on the liberal side were to be replaced, then there's no doubt about the fact that Roe versus Wade could be reversed.
Now, in theory, it could be reversed by such a court. How likely do you think it is that even a court so comprised would agree to hear it, given the fact that this would obviously be the biggest court case to be heard since Roe?
Well, it depends upon the strength of their convictions. If they see Roe as a bad decision, and as I say, the analysts, the academic commentators have criticized it severely. The case, for example, says that that they're not going to deal with the question of whether the fetus is human because that's too complicated a question. But then they go ahead and they make a decision which could not be made in that way if one held that the fetus is a person. As a result of Roe versus Wade, the fetus is not given the protections that the born individual is given. So by implication, the court has contradicted itself. It said, first of all, we're not going to make this decision, and then it goes ahead and makes it implicitly. The problems like this within the decision might very well push a court consisting of those who are conservative, who want to take the Constitution as it was originally written, original intent interpreters of the Constitution, to get rid of Roe versus Wade, simply on the ground that you can't sustain this decision constitutionally.
Did Roe v. Wade leave the personhood of the fetus as an open or unanswered question in any
way? Oh, no. No, of course not. But the decision says within it, we are not going to make this decision. It says that traditionally the only people who have insisted on the personhood of the fetus have been A, Christians, and B, the Hippocratic School of Medicine. All right? And the court says, in a pluralistic society, we can't limit ourselves that way. And then the court goes on to say that during the first trimester of pregnancy, the first three months of pregnancy, it is not possible for any state to legislate against it. So, of course, the court is saying we don't hold that the fetus is a person. The fetus is an object, a thing, and it can be gotten rid of, like a tumor, during the first 3 months.
What would a previous court have done when faced with the prospect of overturning Dred Scott had they said, look, the personhood of the black man is a metaphysical question beyond the purview of this court. We can't answer that question. Or if they would have said, no, the people arguing against slavery have been largely people of religion, Christian arguments being made there, or of, I guess you could even say Hippocratic medicine, who looks at a black man and says, looks like a human being to me in every sense of the word, would they have been able to overturn slavery?
Of course not. Incidentally, when Ronald Dvorkin's book, Life's Dominion, was published, Dvorkin, who was a professor of jurisprudence at Oxford, an American, a liberal, he argued in that book that after all, the abortion question was a religious question, and therefore it should be left to private conscience and shouldn't be legislated. When this was published, he gave a lecture on the subject in London, and I confronted him publicly in the debate, and I said to him, obviously, as an American, you would have taken the same view at the time of the Civil War. You would not have wanted to have the emancipation of the slaves or the amendments to the U.S. Constitution guaranteeing the end of slavery, because you would have said, after all, it's a religious question. People argued on both sides of this religiously, right? And of course, he said, I just don't accept the analogy. Of course he didn't accept the analogy. The analogy is as tight as anything. You are perfectly right. There's no way in the world that one could argue for the elimination of slavery on this basis, nor can one argue that abortion ought to be maintained on this basis.
Dr. Montgomery, if my wife were with child, she isn't, but if she were, and let's say I was a man of some means with a sizable estate, and I were to pass away, and I had named as my beneficiary both my wife and any of my progeny, would that unborn child legally be heir of my property?
Oh, yes, very definitely. The common law has always maintained that in terms of civil benefits, the unborn will be treated in exactly the same way as the born. If let us say, I conceive tonight, and tomorrow I am hit by a bus, and I have a will which says that my estate goes to all of the children, all of my offspring, alive at my decease, then the unborn child that I conceived last night will inherit in the very same way as children who were born years ago. The only area of the law which has created a problem along this line is the criminal law, where quickening has been a criterion for determining the existence of the unborn child. But the reason for that was simply that in the Middle Ages you couldn't tell whether there was a child in the womb unless there was some evidence of movement. And because in the criminal law the penalties are so severe and a person is innocent until proven guilty, it was necessary to prove that if you, let's say, killed an unborn, that the unborn was actually a person. But that was an evidential question. It wasn't a question of substance. And in the civil law, which is far more influential, the unborn has always been treated on the same level as the born.
Now, there has been an act in the United States, the Unborn Victim of Violence Act, also called Lacey and Connors Law from the Scott Peterson case, wherein if a man, for instance, kills a woman who's pregnant and thereby the child, the unborn child, also dies, there are two victims of murder in this case. It was immediately noted when this act was passed that it created certain legal conflicts with the philosophy underpinning Roe and the whole and the legal ramifications of Roe. Would overturning Roe v. Wade clear up a lot of those inconsistencies in U.S. jurisprudence?
Oh, yes, very definitely. And what it would do is to reinforce the position of the common law relative to the personhood of the fetus. As we've said, inheritance law has always argued this way. Property law, one of the most fundamental rules in the law of real property, is the rule against perpetuities. This says that there's a limit as to how long you can tie up your estate. And the rule says that you can only tie it up for 21 years plus the period of gestation after the disappearance of the lives and being at the time the estate is created. The fact that it includes the period of gestation means that it is taking into account the fact that if a child is in the womb, the child also counts. This sort of thing has been a characteristic of the common law since medieval times. And it's interesting to me that justices of the Supreme Court of the United States are so blamed ignorant of this kind of thing. I mean, why wasn't that sort of thing taken into account in Roe versus Wade? And the answer to this is very simple. The justices probably had forgotten the rule against perpetuities.
So, in other words, had the justices of the Roe Court been, giving them the benefit of the doubt, been better informed on these commonly understood matters of law, perhaps they would have thought twice before rendering the Roe decision?
Yes, and, you know, the larger lesson from all of this is that no matter what the law is, no matter what the tradition of jurisprudence is, the most important thing is to have justices that have a superb legal education and, more important, that have a fine value system. If their value system is right, if they understand what is important, and if they're infused by the values that come from Holy Scripture, then you're going to get some decent results. But no matter how good the legal tradition is, if you have people with a lousy value system and an inadequate understanding of the law, the results are going to be catastrophic. There's no way that the history of the law can preserve a society from bad lawyers or bad judges.
Folks, let's hear from you on this issue. Our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Tuesday, the 7th of December. Our call-in number is 505-7850. Or 1-800-730-2727. I'm Todd Wilkin. In about 15 minutes, we'll talk with Pastor Will Whedon. Today, the church remembers St. Ambrose, and we'll hear who he was and what he was all about in about 15 minutes on Issues, Etc. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Another inconsistency in the law, and maybe this is just on my personal perception, but I have a 13-year-old daughter, Dr. Montgomery. If someone were to take her to a doctor to have some sort of medical procedure performed on her, I think it would probably be illegal to do that without my consent or at the very least notifying me that something is being done unless it was an absolute life-saving emergency.
That's quite right.
Yet someone could, in theory, take a 13-year-old girl without parental consent or notification, even across state lines, to procure an abortion. Is this a glaring inconsistency, and what would the overturn of Roe do with this?
Well, of course it's an inconsistency, and that's grounded in the problem that we began with, this lame-brained interpretation of the U.S. Constitution that would apparently guarantee an absolute right of privacy to the pregnant woman. It's on that basis that it would be possible for the 13-year-old to have an abortion without the parents being notified, because the theory is that if someone had to be notified, then that would violate the right of privacy of the pregnant woman. I mean, this is a lot of nonsense. What we do, we're responsible for, and if other people happen to know about it, that's our problem. If we didn't want people to know about it, we probably shouldn't have done it in the first place.
We've perhaps left out one element here, and that is there is at times a third participant in the whole issue of abortion, and that is the man who either coerces a woman or pays for an abortion. After Roe, what becomes of him?
Well, he's analogous, you'll pardon my putting it this way, he's analogous to the pimp who doesn't engage in prostitution, but who in some way finances or aids and abets it. Any proper criminal law dealing with abortion is going to pick up this individual as well. There's no question about that. And in instances which we could easily imagine, that individual would be far more criminally liable than the individual having the abortion or the doctor performing it. It depends upon the degree of pressure that's been brought to bear in the situation. Again, these matters of punishment are matters for the judge and matters for the jury. They are not matters that should in any way influence the existence of the law on the matter. If abortion is wrong, if abortion is homicide, which it certainly is, then anybody participating in this kind of thing is going to be criminally liable in some sense. And that's only reasonable, for goodness sake. I mean, we wouldn't want to have our criminal laws dealing with murder somehow restricted only to the person who does the shooting and not to the capo di familia, the mafia don who brings the thing about.
505-7850-1-800-730-2727. Let's start with Herman, who calls from Illinois. Herman, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you for taking my call. I would like to ask Dr. Montgomery's appraisal of this case. The radical feminist Naomi Wolf has said that, yes, abortion is taking a human life, but that the necessity to liberate women who have been historically oppressed, compel it to be done, and that is the higher goal that should prevail, whereas others have said we don't know if the fetus is a human or not. You have a case there that it's human, it's taking a life, but the feminist liberation is a higher goal that compels it. How would you evaluate that, Dr. Montgomery?
It's a very good question, Herman. Thank you. Dr. Montgomery.
Yes, that's exactly the Al-Qaeda argument for destroying the Twin Towers and the 3,000 people inside. They're going to die. Yes, there are all sorts of hideous consequences, but the end justifies the means. And the end is our higher political goal to, what, liberate Palestine or destroy American economic control throughout the world, et cetera, et cetera. Listen, the end doesn't justify the means anywhere or at any time. No matter what the end happens to be, if the means are monstrous and evil, then the means are monstrous and evil. It's as simple as that.
Vivian calls from her car. Vivian, welcome to Issues Etc.
Yes, I always love when Dr. Montgomery is on. He's such a clear thinker, both scripturally and legally. I have heard that even if a ruling is a bad ruling from the Supreme Court, if it's around long enough, they just won't even address looking at that kind of a law. I wonder if he'd comment about that. And the other thing is the reason that some people give about little teenagers going to get abortions is in case of incest, that these children would have to bear some child because of incest. Gee, that sounds awfully familiar. Sounds like David covering his sin with another sin.
Thank you very much, Vivian. Two points that she raises there. First of all, if Roe is considered stayed precedent in law, does it make it less likely for the Supreme Court to visit it?
Well, of course, if a law, if a decision has been in place for a considerable length of time, it's harder to get it reversed. But Roe versus Wade has only been around for 30 to 40 years, after all. What, 1973? And therefore, it's not as if it had been there since the Great Flood of Noah. And after all, the commentators on it have been uniformly critical of this decision. The decision is poor jurisprudence, and therefore it seems to me that's bound to enter into the picture if a reversal were to be presented as a possibility.
Yeah.
As far as incest is concerned, the problem there is to see if a life created in a way that we would not want ought to be eliminated because of the sins of other people. Because that's exactly what happens in the case of abortion on the basis of incest. The child to be born had nothing to do with this incestuous relationship. There is no a priori reason to think that the child born of such a relationship is going to be an idiot. Such things have, of course, occurred, and if there is a great deal of intermarriage among people in the same family, eventually you do get problems like this. But in the case of unique instances of this, it is certainly unfortunate to kill the one innocent victim in the whole situation. The thing to do, of course, is for the child to be born and to have the child adopted. The prosecution should be against those who have engaged in the incestuous relationship in the first place.
Dr. John Warwick Montgomery has authored and edited more than 50 books, including Slaughter of the Innocents. You can find out more about this book and purchase it on the web at CILTPP.com. It's the website for the Canadian Institute for Law, Theology, and Public Policy, CILTPP.com, or call them at 780-461-3876. The book is called Slaughter of the Innocents. Dr. Montgomery, thank you very much for being our guest.
Oh, you're very welcome. It's always a pleasure.
By the way, Herman, give us a call back. I will send you a copy of this book, Slaughter of the Innocents, by our guest, Dr. John Warwick Montgomery. Dr. Montgomery will be back with us on Thursday this week to discuss the Newsweek magazine cover story, The Birth of Christ. So for you Montgomery fans out there, make sure you tune in, mark your calendars for Thursday's program of Issues Etc. when Dr. Montgomery returns. Now, when we return after this break, we're going to be talking with Pastor Will Whedon of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Today, the church remembers St. Ambrose. We'll find out who he is and why he is important right after this.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.